welcome to the last session of the day. I'd just like to say thank you to Karen and all her helpers for putting this session on this day for the second year in a row. So thank you very much, having amazing speakers and all the speakers and everyone who has been involved. This is our last session. I feel like we must have lots of questions burning, right? So this is kind of like a safe space to kind of exercise those demons. So just like hold on to those things. What we're going to do is we have two amazing panelists here, and we're going to have a few questions. We'll have a conversation about some of the topics, but mostly around kind of AI and the next 5 years. And then we're going to kind of open up and have a discussion with you. So you can ask us and we'll go backwards and forwards until we all give up and leave. Groovy? Super. So before we introduce our panel, I'd just like to introduce, we're recording this session as part of the Machine Ethics podcast. This will actually be the 100th and first episode of the Machine Ethics podcast. Thank you. Yes. I was hoping I wasn't going to have to like make you whoop, so I appreciate it. So I'm Ben Byford. I'm the host of the Machine Ethics podcast. We've been doing this over 8 years now, talking to fabulous people about AI, its impact on society, ethics, and what is now called AI ethics, which wasn't a thing when we started. So to kick us off, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask our panelists to introduce themselves and just give us a little flavour of what they think this thing AI is. So over to you, Lucy.
Thank you very much. And congratulations on your 101 podcast. Very good. Hello, everyone. I'm Lucy Mason. I'm a director at Capgemini Invent. I lead on our innovation and technology areas of the work, and I especially work into defence and security mainly. But I've spent a lot of the last year working with DCIT around AI regulatory policy, AI threats, AI risks, and AI opportunities. So AI has taken over my life, as you can hear from that. I'm also a member of the government's Regulatory Horizons Council, RHC. So we're a group of external experts appointed to advise government on emerging technology trends and how they should be regulated or not, as the case may be. So I also have an interest from that perspective around regulatory policy. My background is that I was a civil servant up until the end of 2019. So I spent most of my career working in government around strategy and policy, working in futures, working in technologies, and really thinking about how do technology and people interact with each other, and what's the role of government and industry and academia in bringing those things together. So shall I go on to what I think AI is?
Yes, please.
Okay. So excellent question to start with, because I think we haven't actually defined it today at all. Mm. We've all just assumed a level of knowledge, and I'm sure you're all much more expert than I am. I think we could do with being much more specific about AI and not use it quite such an umbrella way. So we're talking really about a whole mix of different technologies, which we've brigaded under this term AI. And a lot of people are now using really as a shorthand to mean generative AI, large language models. That's only one sort of aspect of a much wider picture. So I do think it's unhelpful perhaps to be quite so vague in our terminology. So I think possibly a theme that will come out of this, a plea from me, is to sort of really think about the language we use around AI. But you've probably got a much better definition, so over to you.
I don't know about that. hi, so I'm Simon. My background is I did an undergrad in computer science, PhD in applied machine learning, applying machine learning to sports, and then I stayed around the Cambridgeshire Silicon Fen working for various AI tech startups of various sizes and scales and stages as a software engineer, AI engineer, well, software engineer, data scientist, machine learning engineer, AI engineer. Basically the same job, but the name has changed. For the last few years. So that's me. And so AI. So I think we've done a great job today of acknowledging the fact that there is a need for a common language, I think. I also think, like, AI, the term, is a bit like the term data science. It's not particularly clear what it means. And it's got to the point almost, I feel, where we can't really use it anymore. But if I had to define it, I go for the automated prediction of information. And that is done by building a model that can make those predictions. And that model is like a bit like a mirror. So you know, if the model is really accurate, then it's like having like a really perfect mirror of the world or the thing that you are modeling. But if it's not very accurate, it's a bit like going to like a weird hall of mirrors or something. Or like a crystal ball if you're doing a forecasting model, where as you train it, you're sort of polishing the ball to make it more accurate. But yeah, the automated prediction of information.
Cool. Great. So this is supposed to be a conversation about the next 5 years. I feel like some of the talks that we had today have been affecting. I don't know if you feel the same way, that, you know, some very positive things were said and some more negative things were said about this technology. So I just wanted to kind of gauge your feeling from what we heard today, but also just generally in your work, you know, in the next 5 years, are you feeling quite, you know, excited or kind of less so, deflated about maybe the technology side to start? Yeah.
Shall I have a go at that?
Give it a go.
I mean, it would be a brave person who was trying to predict the next 5 years in AI. So I think the definite thing we could say, we'll probably get it wrong. The world of futurists have a long and proud history of getting things wrong. I think my view about especially the pace of change, which is so rapid and so unpredictable, we've heard some of the talks today, you know, about the many ways in which AI might evolve and affect us. So I think it would be sensible to talk about sort of alternative multiple futures and think about how we can be resilient in different possible scenarios. To, you know, perhaps at the extremes, there's the very sort of dystopian future where AI becomes a real threat to us. Perhaps the geopolitics of it becomes very polarized and it becomes about power relationships. And that could sort of have some seriously negative consequences for society. There's the very kind of utopian flip side of that, where all the kind of fantastic benefits of AI just come to fruition, none of the risks do, and we all just have a, you know, amazing, fantastically improved lives as a result of the AI that we're using. Or there could be sort of a mass rejection of AI, where actually we just don't yield any of these benefits because people don't want to use AI. We move on to the next big thing, and in 5 years' time, we'll all be looking back going, do you remember when we used to talk about AI? That used to be a thing, didn't it? Or it'll just evolve into something else, or we'll call it something else. And perhaps there's the future I sort of hope for as a fourth future, is one in which, you know, in 5 years' time, we're all still sat here, life goes on, we seem pretty, you know, much as we are now, but things are a bit easier, perhaps we're a bit more prosperous, and AI has just become absorbed into our daily lives, you know, as any other bit of software. We've understood how to manage it, and we just feel, you know, pretty happy to use it. I think there will be some kind of cultural changes around some areas, but I think we'll adapt quite quickly to those. So that would be, I suppose, the more benign future that we might look at.
Perfect.
Oh yeah, I can't wait, I think. Yeah, I love a gadget. I think I feel sort of as excited as I did when I was wanting to be a programmer at school, I think, which was a number of 5 years ago. Mm. Technology is always advancing, and we're just a point on that timeline. Mm. So yeah, lots of interesting discoveries to be found, lots of empowering to be done, lots of connecting with people to be done over it, probably more ways to connect with people to come. So great power, but with great power comes great responsibility.
Mm. Yeah. It sounds like you kind of have this positive outlook that we'll deal with it. Is that kind of what you're saying? Like that some of the things that we have looked at today, or just some of the kind of more bias or ethical, or like some of those issues inherent in what we call AI ethics or responsible AI, we'll just kind of, you know, take that forward and deal with those issues.
I think we'll always keep inventing things. We'll always be curious. We'll always keep inventing things. There will always be people who want or need to make money, and so the wheels will keep turning.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll have to deal with it. We will deal with it.
Yeah. But do you think some people were more prosperous than others, maybe?
As always, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Do you want to add anything to that, Lucy?
I think the wheels will keep turning. I think we'll see economic disruption in some sectors. That seems pretty likely as AI gets adopted in more, you know, in a very uneven way, but undoubtedly sort of more rapidly into some areas. I think you know, culturally, we'll learn to trust AI, and some of the things which sort of seem a bit weird to us now will just become very normal. You know, people adapt very quickly to these things. I think AI could play a big role in sort of reskilling, so to help with that kind of labour market disruption. I think, you know, equally, the we talked a bit about using AI for sort of educational tools. I think there's huge potential in that to help reskill people. You know, we've got skills shortages all over the place. We could do a fantastic job of trying to help people realise their ambitions and dreams in different ways and make it more accessible for them to change careers. That would be a really sort of positive benefit I could see from it. But then, as I'm a defence and security person, I also feel bound to say that I think we'll see a huge uplift in malicious use of AI in ways which could be extremely harmful. I think we've already seen that around fraud and sort of serious organised crime groups. I think that will absolutely skyrocket. We're at the foothills of what will be a mountain of fraud coming our way, which will be enabled by AI to do, you know, things like very bespoke targeted phishing attempts en masse. Everyone constantly, you know, these are the sorts of things that we need to be thinking now about building tools to try, indeed using AI, to try to prevent those kinds of fraud. And I work a lot, you know, a lot of my job is thinking about how would a bad actor use these things in ways which could be very harmful. They're obviously not bothered about whether they're breaking the law in doing so. So, you know, the question of whether it's illegal is kind of moot. The question of whether we can stop them doing it is one of law enforcement, largely, and our intelligence agencies and perhaps defence, and thinking about how can we, you know, actually prevent these tools falling into the hands of these people and being used in those ways. I think that's incredibly difficult at the moment. We could talk more about that, perhaps.
That just made me think, I suppose one thing which I think maybe so much of a matter of degree that it is a matter of a different kind, is the nature of software is that it abstracts. So we no longer write in machine code. Maybe we program in Python. Actually, we no longer do that. We use type into ChatGPT to write some Python for us. So that's what I mean by layers of abstraction. I think software has always been, and maybe becoming particularly, a very complex system with so many layers of abstraction. I wonder how many other things there are with that many layers of abstraction, and that makes it quite a complex thing to understand. And there's a lot of room for misunderstanding in that. So I think that is maybe a particular challenge with this technology that we haven't seen with other technologies, where we've found a way of making it really complex really quickly.
Yeah, and pulling those kind of two threads together, and like you mentioned education, I think one of the things that the government had a lot of money put into, and I know that one of the Nordic countries had educational resources about AI and how it operates. So I was wondering, how much do we know we need to teach people about AI itself? You know, how much do you think you need to tell your mum or your spouse, like, that they need to understand this and it's going to be important, or maybe not so?
Yeah, I think education is a really important thread or pillar of responsible AI. Yeah, because of that level of complexity. I think everyone is on a different place in their journey, their AI journey. I had that term before today. I think even in this room, I think there are so many people who are at different places on their AI journey. I think that might be the biggest challenge. If you ask me like, what is one of the biggest challenges, I think that getting everyone on the same page, from the boardroom to the graduate software engineer.
But you think that they should be on the same page? That's the thing that we should be doing.
We need to be on the same page, yes.
Right.
doing AI, using AI. So many people who want to use AI at the moment. So in the private in sector in industry, like that sort of experience I have, I think doing that in a company is a holistic thing that needs to happen from the board and the C-suite right down to the new employees.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of all of that whole stack needs to be on the same page because it all influences each other, and that there are things that need to be coded up that can only be done if you have the right data, that can only be done if you have the right relationships with the right people and have hired the right people. So it all filters down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that goes for all organisations that are looking to use the technology. But do you think it's important that, you know, as citizens, you know, not necessarily people in organisations using, you know, hoping to use machine learning or, you know, using the next whatever generative AI model, Barbara, let's say, you know what I mean? Do you think everyone should be at a certain level kind of across the country almost? About that knowledge?
Not really, actually. I'm not a deep tech expert at all. I spend a lot of my time trying to learn enough about the technology. I'm at large, I'm interested in sort of thinking about applications of it. I'm very happy to leave kind of the deep technical expertise to other people and be a sort of translator. But as we all know, like, the pace of change is so quick that you can spend all day, every day, trying to educate yourself about AI and barely be anywhere near the cutting edge. So we can hardly ask that of everyone. Like, we do nothing else other than learn about AI all day, every day. I do spend a lot of time with my clients trying to find ways to talk about AI with them, often, you know, even less technically expert than me, in ways which help them understand how they might think about it, some of the risks, some of the challenges, what they might do about these things. And kind of that's what they really want to understand, is what does this mean for me and what should I do? You know, what should I take away from this conversation and what should I do tomorrow? That's helpful kind of knowledge for them. But I don't think everyone needs kind of the deep understanding.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a surface level, like, this is kind of what it's doing, this is kind of what you can use it for, these are probably kind of the issues, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a bit being a critical user of it, perhaps, and being an understanding what it is doing and what it isn't doing. And that's where I think, to come back to the language point, that a lot of the language used around, especially large language models, is actually quite misleading for people who are not technically minded at all and don't really understand what it's doing. Describing it to them as doing reasoning or thinking or having agency or autonomy, which I would say are all very contested terms, really implies that it's doing something that it isn't really. And we talked about anthropomorphizing earlier. Yep. It encourages them to think of it like it was a human and to treat it like it was a person, whereas in fact we shouldn't be doing anything like that, and we should be treating it quite critically and with full understanding of what it is and isn't doing.
I totally agree with that point. I think we can't expect everyone to have the same level of knowledge about everything. That would be very boring, right? But at whatever level you would like to get into it, it's important that what you're getting into is true and well communicated. But also, I think another point is AI, for me, is a very interdisciplinary discipline, area, field, pursuit, endeavour. So any encouragement we can give for people to be, as they go through their education, their career, curious about what the other side is doing, or the other sides are doing, and be open to, like, trying to work together with that. So for me, like, AI is about building a model, so you need to be. So that requires people who can, like, lay bricks, but also people who can draw houses. And it's no good if the people who lay the bricks don't want to look at the pictures. Or it's no good if the people who are drawing the pictures are going to draw pictures that can't be built with the bricks. Mm. So I'm not sure I'm in a position to know how well we're doing with that in schools and things like that at the moment. But I think, I guess there's a sort of inclusivity vibe going around at the moment. Maybe that can include the open-minded, interdisciplinary aspect.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people in this room might be familiar with some of those technologies, and it might be that they are going to be advising people. I've certainly talked to some of them about how people should be using this technology in their organization. And there's a lot of challenges around that with the technical aspect, for sure, but just on the kind of regulatory framework, responsible AI side of things, there's a lot going on. And then if you combine that with things which haven't really kind of sorted themselves out yet, in one of the industries I work quite closely with, cultural industries, there's just IP. It's just, it has to work itself out. Right, because it's we can't move forward at the moment making things at all with AI, because this idea of IP hasn't quite got a properly legal standing with the use of generative AI. So I wondered, you know, what are the challenges that people have in actually using AI in this kind of frameworks and regulation situation?
Yeah, I think part of the problem, actually, which hinders some of the AI adoption we talked about earlier, is just uncertainty around it all. So we don't have a well-developed regulatory framework landscape, amazingly, because the technology is like literally sort of barely evolving the last few years to the kind of level that we're at now. And regulation usually takes a very long time to catch up and is slow and has to be thought through. And we've had, you know, various attempts to kind of push and pull in different directions. So the US's attempt, which they're now rowing back from, the EU's very different approach to the whole sort of regulatory piece, and the UK sort of, I don't want to say flip-flopping, perhaps trying to sort of occupy a middle ground position where we're trying to work out how do we create a permissive enough environment to enable innovation so that's going to allow the UK to prosper from AI technologies, which we would like to do because prosperity is brilliant for all of us. But equally, how we're going to manage the safety aspects of that and feel that we've got sufficient regulation that bad things aren't going to happen. And we're still in that space of trying to understand and pass out what's needed and what should we do. So I've been involved with government with some of the discussions about the creation of an AI regulator as a potential sort of move in the UK. And that's been a very interesting kind of conversation with them about, is there a need for a regulator? How might you create one? What should it look like? What should it do? What powers should it have? You know, do we need an AI regulator? Or do we, in fact, not really want to regulate the technology, but regulate the applications of the technology in different sectors? In which case, is it more useful to upskill the existing regulators in how they should regulate AI? And at those, that's all kind of very live discussion.
And the ICO was involved in that previously,
I believe. They've been very good about it. Yeah, they're all over AI. Okay, they do lots of good stuff.
Yep. Yeah. I wonder if your clients have this challenge. You know, what do they tell you about this kind of issue, Simon?
I think there are so many regulations and frameworks and links to read up on. It's a bit overwhelming. And so, like, some of the things we've seen today, I think, are really helping with that, to sort of, like, condense it down. But I do think it's still, these frameworks are still a little bit abstract. And if we could work bottom up as well, so, you know, how do you actually? Transparency is important, for example. So that has very real effects for how you go and collect your training and evaluation data, and the schema of your database that you need to store that data, and the fact that you need to be able to have like migration algorithms for your database, because you will get the schema wrong to begin with. I think we need to fill in the rest of those frameworks with the actual how do you make this happen in reality details. Especially in startups, I think there is actually in all of industry, I think there is a choice of metrics that the management leadership team are following, which dictate how much effort and time you can put into doing things in a responsible way. And I think
there. Is that limited? The responsible part.
So time and money is limited.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it depends how you choose to use that time. That's the question. So that's dictated by the metrics that you're trying to optimize for your business. So if you're trying to optimize the bottom line, that's one thing. If you're trying to make things quicker or more efficient in some way, that's another thing. But those are not the only things you can do. But they are things that are very. That can be very motivating to some people, and that can be very easily measured. but maybe some things which are not so easily measured, but can also be really important, like how trustworthy is your system, like how transparent, how authentic it is, how safe it is, what is your test coverage? I think those things are easily overlooked sometimes. But if you get that right, if you're happy with, if you've taken an intentional approach to your metrics choice, then everything else should flow, and you can choose to use the time and whatever to fulfill those things.
Yeah, I feel like in the past, when I've advised people on some of those things, it's kind of like, if you do all these things, that the AI legislation will be okay, because you've basically got all the information they need. You know what I mean? So it's like, if you do it like in a certain way to start, then you're already set up for success in the legislative landscape almost. So I'm going to ask one more question and then I'm going to throw it open, okay? So I've been dying to ask people today, because in my mind, it feels like everyone just uses other people's stuff at the moment, you know? I'm just going to use the service, it does the thing. So should we be making our own models, or should we be using off-the-shelf services?
We, the UK.
Anyone. The UK, citizens, businesses, yeah.
So I really think that the UK needs to have a sovereign AI capability. And certainly from a defence and national security perspective, I think it's absolutely imperative that we do that. We should have invested in it years ago. We're already running to catch up. So we're already, we're not going to be in a position to build a frontier model anytime soon, because we haven't got the money to invest in it. We could possibly buy a mid-sized model or something like that and create, turn it into a sovereign capability. But the reason being, I don't think that strategically we can allow ourselves to be completely dependent on US frontier models. I think that's a really dangerous position to be in, especially with what's happening in the US. And I just think, for the UK's future, it's really imperative that we try and develop better models in the UK. I'd also think that, we could really carve out a position in the sort of small to medium edge models, lightweight models. That could be somewhere where the UK could really specialise, because we need to find somewhere where we're playing a role in this global AI ecosystem. We've got to specialise in something, bring something to the table that gives us some leverage. And so we really ought to get after something like that. We've got great research, great expertise in the UK. We're not leveraging that nearly well enough. So that would be my take on it.
Super, thank you.
So build versus buy, I think that is a business decision often. As in, if you're a business, that's a business decision. And some of the factors that come into that are, so one thing, it does depend on so part of that project management triangle of like time and money and scope is like, how fast can your team build stuff? How good are they at building stuff? So hiring good talent, good engineers is something to bear in mind. It comes into this, I think. And then therefore the education of good engineers. If you build it yourself, then you can customize it, like you're saying, basically. And that can make things more efficient, because you don't have to make do. You've got exactly what you need. Generally, I'm a big advocate of agile. But I think maybe in AI, which is so uncertain, I think agile becomes particularly important. And agile would say that you code in a way that you expect to delete and rewrite your code. I almost give, sometimes I give people in my teams the task of say, here's a task, do it, brilliant. Now do it again, but in half the lines of code. Because deleting code is a good thing. Doing that sort of customization, that's what you can do if you build it yourself. If you don't build it yourself, then you're generating no IP. Your company is, these companies who try to wrap these foundational models, they haven't really discovered anything from themselves about how the world works, and that's really what AI is all about. It's one big science experiment, or lots of little science experiments, and that's where you understand knowledge. What you're revealing, your conclusions reveal something about a deeper understanding of the world that you're trying to model. That is the IP that AI companies have. That gives you protection.
I like the idea that it's one big science experiment. I feel like we are being experimented on right now. I don't know how you feel about it. So should we have some mics? Is that okay? Has anyone got any questions for the panel? There's one right at the back, there's one down here, and there's one on the right here. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the podcast live. I was chatting to Ben during one of the breaks, but firstly, I'm a PhD student in AI safety at University of York. I'm focusing my work on psychological safety of AI, which is very sketchy, murky in definition, for all good reasons we've already discussed. And I'm focusing my work on older people, their adoption of digital technologies, and the role of AI in facilitating independent living in assisted care. And the more I read, the more I find that in this whole AI race, we're actually leaving a very big subset of our population behind, something we call AI ageism. And that's only one subset. There are lots of other people who are not represented in data at all because of obvious reasons in data collection feasibility. And what do you think about the next 5 years? You talk about as our population ages, the demographics shift even more. And as we all grow older, possibly AI at that level would be something that we would not be represented in something like that. So I just generally wanted to have your thoughts about this whole idea of AI ageism.
Cool. Any thoughts?
Your general point, I guess, about inclusivity is really important, and making sure that there's equity in access and being able to benefit from these tools in an equal way. And indeed, it might be even more important for some particular groups of society to have access to those tools, and they're not necessarily the people who will have the education or the wealth or whatever in order to be able to use them. So I do think, certainly from a government and public sector perspective, we need to really think hard about when we introduce AI into delivery of public services to make sure that they're really accessible to everyone and that we're not leaving people behind. I think, sort of touching back on my sort of possible futures, I think maybe it won't matter in that we're not asking everyone to go and use AI tools themselves, but they'll just be incorporated in services that we use, and you won't know or notice that there's any AI happening there at all. But hopefully it should make it more user-friendly. So if you can go and talk to a chatbot that can talk in your language, that can tailor things to how you want to learn or how you want to communicate, that ought to be more accessible than having to go and type into a website or something like that. So I do think there's lots of kind of good uses of AI like that.
I suppose AI can help in the communication about AI. Yes. But communication needs to be for everyone. If you're old, if you're young, if you're disabled in some way, or just odd in your own way. That's the challenge of communication, is just to be able to transfer thoughts between anyone. Mm. Can we come up with any tools that are specific for the elderly generations, I guess? Try to pick things that are relatable for them. So maybe email is the way to help the older generation rather than chatbots. I think also on this point, I think it's a cool application that I hear people talk about. Is it like a AI companion for the elderly? That sort of can feed into this because to help with loneliness. Mm-hmm. And maybe that could be the chatbot that also teaches them about AI. If it was a responsible elderly companion, then it would include an element of like, what is this? Who am I? I'm an elderly companion. What does that mean? Mm. Yeah, but also I think you touch on this idea of how different communities are represented within the data sets. Yes, because I mean, if you do have an elderly companion chatbot, then you will have data sets which include dialogues from elderly people. Yeah.
I've got two pithy comments about this actually. So idea one, right? Most of the frontier models, they use internet text, right? So we just write loads of stuff on the internet about old people. We just like loads of memoirs everywhere. Flood it with memoirs. And then what's the other idea? Maybe we'll all lose our job and we'll all become carers anyway, so it's fine. Next question, please. I think we had one down here and one in the middle before, and then we've got three more as well.
I'll go here and then go along.
Lucy, you touched on building sovereign AI capacity for the UK. I wondered, in terms of us kind of carving out a position, what are some of the main areas, A, we should specialise in, and B, what's easiest to sell as being, could be uniquely UK? Mm.
Great question, yeah. I think there's something to be said for building on our existing strengths there. So the ideal thing would be somewhere the UK is already really strong, where AI could really have an impact, and where we can sort of overcome any barriers from a sort of feasibility perspective to adopt AI in that area. So, you know, what are we really great at in the UK? Well, I guess the first one is the city, financial services, legal services. We are world leading in the sort of monetary systems and legal systems, and we could be applying AI into those areas to be even better, be even more competitive into those sectors. Higher education, I know we did touch on earlier, and mixed reviews. I've talked to lots of academics who are quite anti-AI, I suppose, because they see it as something that allows students to cheat. We probably need to totally rethink higher education as a result. But be that as it may, we have a world-leading R&D higher education ecosystem. We are known throughout the world for doing that really well. We should be applying AI to those problems and being really cutting edge in that stuff, I think. And then creative industries, to go even more controversial, because a lot of people in the creative industries hate AI and are really, really opposed to ever going near it. They see it as taking their jobs, taking their IP, deeply threatening who they are as people. But the UK is fantastic at creative industries. There's so much that can be done by responsibly and usefully harnessing AI to that. We could really get after some of that and make that, you know, a big prosperity play for the UK. And then defence and security, just because we absolutely need to.
Yeah.
Can I say something? Yeah. A couple of points just that's made me think of is, maybe it's a good experiment to find out what it is about the UK that is unique. Let's build a model of the UK is something, and then let's find out what that is. But on the cultural, the arts thing, so two things. Yeah, one, I think this might be the hardest, most worrying problem in the whole of AI is getting the artists, the content creators, the training set authors the credit that they deserve. It's almost as if it's you know how like tech you used to have to pay for text messages, but now you don't have to. It's like the opposite of that. We should have been charging people for all the data, but it started off as free, and now we're trying to like get it chargeable, because it's so hard to tell a fake, and it's hard to decide whether you're allowed to use a calculator or not. So how are the people going to get the credit that they deserve? It's very hard. And the advice I offer is to not use models if you don't know where the data's come from, which might mean jumping back a couple of years and starting again. And then also on the creativity thing, I think I heard Will.i.am say something really cool on BBC Click? I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say those words. You can edit them out.
No, it's fine.
Okay, cool.
Is it swearing words?
No. Like names of people.
Go for it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, no, I said, look it up. It's on BBC iPlayer, I think. So, but he said, so, because someone asked him, so are you worried about AI-generated music? And he was like, I make music. I'm a musician as well. I make music because I want to express myself. And I go and listen to music because I want to connect with those people who are playing. And so I'm not going to stop, and people are not going to stop going to concerts, because that's always going to be the case. And if the music is made through responsible crediting systems as well, even better, cool more instruments. But then what if the music? What if the automated systems make better music than I can?
Mm.
But I mean, so what about Mozart? What about Stevie Wonder? They inspire me. They don't put me off from making music. So more the merrier, sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I feel like I need to disagree with Will.i.am, because I feel like he's in the privileged position that he is, right? That he's accrued some sort of monetary outcome from his art, right? And in the future, that won't be the case for people. They won't be able to get money from their art anymore. So I think it's not actually the art for Will.i.am. If he's here, is he here? No. Okay. But it's not really about that. Part of the equation is about that, because you want to connect with people and you want to feel like we are humans and we are expressing ourselves and we have this autonomy and all these sorts of things. Mm. But if we want to exist in this economic situation, we either have to change the situation or we don't do that job anymore. For me, that's the critical part of the creative industries is facing at the moment.
Mm.
We can't make films anymore. In the next 5 years, films will be a very different place, in the same way that music is a different place because of Spotify. And then it moves again forward, where you have control over people's generated voices and stuff like that. So I feel, unlike you maybe, Simon, I feel very negative about that situation, but it's mostly because the economics of it don't really work out as we are currently facing it. So there's all these battles in the law at the moment about the IP over certain newspapers, stuff going into large models. And a lot of that is going to just have repercussions across the board for what you can put into training data. And that's going to affect images, it's going to affect film, it's going to affect everyone. So I'm interested to see that sort itself out, basically.
I'm totally sympathetic to all of that point of view. But there's nothing sort of historically inevitable that says there should be an ability to make money from your art. And it may be
just stab me.
But people will always want to create art because there's something fundamental about being human. But you might not be able to make a career of it, and that just, we may have had a little brief
bit
of history.
You heard it here first, guys.
Where you could make a career from it, and maybe that's over.
It's brilliant. We'll go back to ancient Greece and we'll just have loads of lovely people wandering around making art and everyone else doing
but maybe all the economy will be disrupted so much
that
we will have to totally rethink sort of the capitalist model of money making
I'm on board with. Yeah, exactly.
I remember
last question. Okay, we'll go to the last question. Maybe you can feed it into it. Over there, there's a hand. Maybe you could piggyback off each other. I don't know.
It was more to pick up on something that in relation to the previous question about apps for the elderly. One of the things we've sort of maybe touched upon a bit throughout today, but not properly, is real accountability and how you use the law to hold, the tech companies or the implementers or people to account for products that are faulty. And in a situation where legal aid has been completely decimated, I struggle to see how that will happen. Bringing you judicial review is vastly expensive and beyond the means of most people. Big companies will fight back and you just won't be able to hold them to account through the courts, even if you tried to bring a group action, which is already pretty hard and much more feasible in the US. So, perhaps there's elements of liability, but you also, enter the era of potential, the sort of slap law, so it's in advance of bringing them. So, I wondered if you could discuss that and how an old person, when an app goes wrong, can hold it to account, or indeed when you're trying to claim benefits.
Do you want to give the mic just down here and we'll put them together and see what happens?
Okay.
Yeah, quickly, as succinctly as possible. Thank you.
I don't think they fit, but I'll...
Okay, yeah.
So, picking up on the subject of IP, if we accept that the vast majority of systems in the future are going to be based on tokenization of language, and language is how we express ourselves, how we communicate, how we create art, why is it that we can't apply a token to every single token that we create, whether through a chat agent, that represents us? Whether that's the attribution of our conversation, our art, our materials to us, because then you can, given the law, potentially have something that attributes the IP associated with that, or the conversation associated with that, because that's really what we're talking about, is attribution.
I feel like these are very small questions, which we'll sort out straight away for you.
I have an answer to the first one,
okay,
at least,
great.
So I can have a go
Thank
at
you.
That. So hopefully we can all agree that AI as a technology is a tool. It's not responsible for what it does. We cannot bring an AI into court. Yeah, maybe in a future where it becomes a sufficiently sort of conscious entity, where it has genuine legal autonomy, then you could bring it into court. But at the moment, people are responsible for what they do with AI. So that makes things reasonably simple from a sort of legal perspective. A crime is still a crime if you use AI to do it. You are responsible for whatever you've done with the AI tool that you've been given. And so largely, a lot of the existing kind of criminal body of law covers that quite well. And I have done quite an extensive bit of analysis of this, so I can say that with some certainty. There is also an interesting provision in the Serious Organised Crime Act, which does give you a certain, not been explored in law, but could give you some way to hold people to account who are further up the supply chain for the tools they have created and brought to market. But largely, as long as companies have exercised reasonable due diligence and meet product safety requirements and so on, they have covered themselves in terms of bringing those things to market.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, though, I think some of these companies do tick the box to say yes, that we've covered this, but it might be because they've had to hand over. So here's a system, here's evaluation results, here's domain expert. Is that okay? Does that look okay for you? They'll be like, yes, that's fine. But the thing is, if they don't have the understanding of how the system works, then they may start to trust the system in a way that it shouldn't be trusted, because you can't trust the machine in the same way that you can trust a human, even though it looks like it's doing a human. So you know, a human does this, so I trust it won't do that again. You can't say that about a machine, because they have all these little corners of the hyperspace. So so that's the problem with like them saying, yes, it's fine. Because yeah, are you sure? To go back to the artist thing, when the credit and also the legal question and the accountability, the answer is what you said, is to track it. So if we haven't collected the training data with enough metadata, then we're a bit stuck. If you can take a large language model and instead of using it, actually start to think about the more specific model, potentially linguistic model, that you're actually trying to hope that the LLM has covered. You start to think about that model and start breaking it down a bit, and then use the LLM to fill in the little details, you know, put the leaves on the tree. Maybe that gives you a bit more of an explainable model, which you can train different parts of, and so you can start to bring in some explainability and some tracking. But that's the challenge.
So I'm afraid to say we've been told that that's our time. Thank you very much to our two panelists. Thank you to you and your questions. Thanks for coming to this conference today. Please tell your colleagues and friends that I'm hoping we'll see it next year, and that they should definitely come. Do check out the... Yeah, we'll see you next year. Check out the podcast. Do talk to us afterwards. Is that okay?
Yeah,
yes. And I'm sure that many of you have more expertise in some of these areas. So please tell us things as well. That'd be fabulous. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'll see you later. Bye.
Thank you.